what you want, tell me what you see, where you wanna go, what you wanna be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of prayer. If you take your time, gotta be precise, gotta have a plan, double check it twice. Wait, hold up, slow down, devil need advice. Someone's gone before, maybe talk to them. Then after you do, go and talk to him. Great, it's gonna come, maybe not tonight. Take your time today, teach you something right.
Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends. Twitter, you the trend, even Bentley Benz. But you moving kinda fast. Keep sweats, you gotta make it last. Live every day like it's your last. But don't forget to have a blast.
Welcome, welcome to Time Out. I am your host, Sylvia Crawley Milbury, and I want to remind everybody to check out the WNBA playoffs. I believe the finals are going on, and so you definitely do not want to miss it. The basketball is intense, ladies and gentlemen. And then also, Beyond the Bounce Retreat. This is a retreat for current WNBA players who are obviously not in the playoffs right now. The ones who are going fishing can join us in Miami at the Riviera South Beach Hotel. We're doing a retreat called Beyond the Bounce. It's for current and former WNBA players. I'm going to be the keynote speaker on Thursday morning session, so hopefully I see some of my fellow WNBA players there. But support the WNBA Finals. These ladies are playing their little hearts out. The games have been intense, so I'm looking forward to watching the games. Tonight, I have a special show lined up for you. I've had a chance to interact with this young man throughout this week, and I can say this is going to be one of the realest shows that I've had so far. It's going to be real talk. I have the pleasure and the honor of introducing to you playwright and author Jermaine Smith. Jermaine, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. How are you doing? And thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for being on the show and for taking time out of your busy schedule. I want to just jump right into getting our listeners to learn more about you, first of all. I think there's a lot of people who aspire to write plays and to write books, and they think for certain people who have done it, like a Tyler Perry and some others, that it's been an easy journey for them. But, I often tell people, if you want what people have, you got to go through what they went through to get it. And so we're going to hear your story tonight and some of the things that you've gone through throughout your life to make you into the man that you are today. So, Jermaine, can you tell us about your upbringing? What type of upbringing did you have?
Well, first I want to thank God for entrusting me with the gifts to write. Without God, I wouldn't be here today. He shielded me through some of the journeys and trials, tribulations that, we're going to talk about tonight. I was a young brother. I lost my father when I was 4. My mother was a substance abuse user for 20-plus years. She used crack cocaine, and that pretty much was the environment, I was into. It was just me, my mother, and my sister for a very long period, and it was very hectic. It was chaotic. My mother, like I said, used drugs, and she had different types of traffic coming in and out of the house to support her habit, So I visually saw her, get physically abused. I visually saw her, have sex with men to support her habit, and I had tried to shield my sister from it and, also shield myself, So it was very rough, and it gave me a lot to write about, gave me a lot to think about, and a lot to contemplate as a young child.
Right. Now, you have two sons of your own. How has losing your father at 4 years old, and as well as the dynamics of your family with your mom being on drugs, how has that affected how you parent your two sons?
Well, it affected me in one major way. I spent a lot of time with my father in the 4 years that I did have him. I went almost everywhere that I could go at that age with him. I vividly remember, sitting on his shoulders, on his afro, just going pretty much getting everywhere with them, So I try to do the same thing with my children because, the first 4 years of my oldest son, Kyrie, was the scariest years of my life because I think, you know, what if the same thing happens to me, to him? You know, he loses me after 4 years. And currently, you know, I go through that now with my two-year-old, you know. So I try to spend as much moment and times and meaningful moments with them as possible because, you know, consistency is the main thing. They don't, kids only know what they see. So I just try to be consistent in their lives, even if I don't have the money to do the things they want or provide what they want at that moment. So I just try to stay consistent in their lives that they see my face and they enjoy me and I enjoy them.
Right. And so given that your father passed away early in your life, are there times where you feel like since you didn't have as much time with your father that, you know, you didn't really have a blueprint for fatherhood and so you were trying to navigate your way through that and teach that to your boys?
Well, it's 100% I felt that way. I didn't have a blueprint because there was no one around to tell me to open up a door for a woman. There was no one around to tell me, I asked a woman how was her day. You know, there was no one for me to ask, how do I express my feelings to a female that I may be interested in or to learn the things that a young man should be learning from his father. So there was definitely that era and that period of, you know what, I'm missing out on my childhood because one, I had to be my mother's husband, my sister's big brother, my sister's father. So you miss out on that childhood. You miss out on those lessons learned. So I try, you know, to teach my boys what I've learned, to learn behavior from my aunts because my aunts raised me, my grandmother raised me, my mother raised me, but none of them could replace, you know, your father at any point.
Now, what, did you have an outlet? Like what kept you from just, you know, a lot of times when you don't have a father figure, you tend to move towards the streets because those are where the men are, you know, and that's what you see, that's what you do. So did you have an outlet or someone in your life to kind of say, hey, this is what you do, Jermaine, this is how you carry yourself, and this is how you tie a tie, you know, was there someone there in the neighborhood that you can look to for that?
Well, I definitely had my friends growing up, but the main source I would say would be my grandmother, my father's mother, who has now passed away as well in 92. She got caught HIV from a blood transfusion in the early 80s. You know, she eventually died in 92. She was a great influence. She spoiled me to death. I was her only son at the time. And my aunt, my mother's sister, who pretty much, you know, kept me afloat, you know, as a young teen, as a young man, you know, you had them thoughts of suicide. Well, I did. I can't say other people, you know, because you didn't know why and what was the next move and, you know, why would God do such a thing for you? Because I didn't have God in my life at such an early age. I had my grandmother who loved God, you know, so they pretty much were the main influence outside of writing. You know, I wrote so much that, you know, I had to go see a psychiatrist at, you know, the age of 8, 9, and 10 because how vivid, you know, I wrote in the parameters of why I was writing, you know, a drug-addicted parent and a deceased father, you know. So writing and sports, you know, pretty much is my outlet. I didn't venture too far into the streets because, you know, my grandmother aunts made sure I knew right from wrong, and it just wasn't my thing. You know, I had other family members who, you know, that was their thing, and it wasn't for me.
Right. Now, you talk about sports. You played basketball, and so can you talk about your basketball career and kind of how that became an outlet for you?
Yeah, well, I started on baseball and track. I was definitely a track runner. I was definitely a baseball player. And in high school, I had a nice growth spurt, you know, and that's when a college coach pulled you on, I mean, a high school coach pulled you on your shoulder and say, look, I want you to try this, you know. But I was more so into baseball. I was a varsity baseball player freshman year, track, you know. So then that sophomore year, you know, you got tall. And eventually, senior year, I won a city championship with my high school team, Madison Square Garden. Play small forward, and, you know, had a great time. It was a great experience. I wasn't the man, but I was one of the key supporting roles and one of the guys that was the glue on the team, you know, that kept everybody in line and kept everybody on the same page and, you know, first one to practice, last one to leave type of guy.
Okay, so you were a worker bee. What would you say was the strength of your game? Were you a slasher? Were you a rebounder? Were you a shooter?
Oh, if you want to talk about back in the days, I was a slasher. I was a slasher and a high flyer. Now, if you want to go 2 years ago, back to the basket, pounded in the post, you know. But in my young years, I was a high flyer. You know, I could jump over just about anybody in the gym, jump as just as high as anybody in the gym, you know. So definitely was a slasher, high flyer. You know, it was one of those things where you can jump so much and so high, you didn't work on no other part of your game. You know, I fell victim to that early. You know, I pretty much got better after high school. I said, you know what? it's time to shoot some jump shots. It's time to work on your handle. You know, you can't just jump over everybody, you know, on the next level.
I hear nowadays you got a 2-inch vertical, though.
You know, I could jump over a phone book now, but I choose not to. I choose not to, you know, but I still get out there here and there. But, you know, the injuries don't heal the same, and, you know, but I get out there competitively with my son. You know, I pretty much try to play him once a week. Game is 11. I let him get to 10 before I just score my next straight 11. But I try to stay competitive with him to let him know, you know, this is what, you know, if this is what you want to do, I'm going to get out here with you, regardless of my age, regardless of so on and so forth. As long as, you know, I don't get hurt, and he's learning.
Right. Now, Jermaine, you talked earlier about your grandmother and how she had a strong relationship with God. How much did she play in terms of you making a decision to accept God into your life? Talk about your relationship with God.
Well, she didn't play a major part because she passed away in 92. I was a senior in high school, and every day after practice, I would run to the hospital. I didn't know at the time she had HIV, didn't know the time it turned into full-blown AIDS. You know, I learned, you know, years later that it was a blood transfusion. And but she constantly stayed in church when I was a young teen, and she would take me, you know, certain Sundays without a church, but it was a turnoff because I was forced to go. You know what I mean? At such a young age, so I was forced, didn't want to be there, so on and so forth. It was in the latter years, you know, that I definitely, you know, tried to get a relationship with God, which happened through, you know, an unfamiliar, uncertain, untimely family event, which was the death of my nephew.
Okay. Well, I do believe that your grandmother was putting up a lot of prayers for you to make that step, so hopefully she is smiling and very proud of you now. Jermaine, talk about your greatest timeout moment. And for my guests who are listening, when I say timeout moments, those are when you think about a timeout in sports. That's when both teams pause, they assess the situation, they correct or adjust some things, they regroup, and they resume with an opportunity to perform better. So given that, Jermaine, what would you say was your greatest timeout moment in your life thus far?
I would have to say my greatest timeout moment was the untimely death of my nephew. You know, he was 2 years old at the time, about 8-9 years ago, and he had sickle cell. And he had an attack one night, and my sister took him to the hospital, and they diagnosed him for having a sickle cell attack when he never normally had, at the time he had a fever by the time he got to the hospital, it was just a fever. So he went directly, immediately into a coma and never woke up. You know, and this right here event took my mother on the tailspin, my sister on the tailspin, took me on the tailspin, my entire family. My mother went to church that following Sunday, gave her life to God, quit drugs, and never looked back. You know, so I would definitely say that is my greatest timeout moment because it changed the dynamics of my mother's life, my sister's life, and my life. You know, that in turn got us into church, which is Love Fellowship Tabernacle, which Bishop Hezekiah Walker's church. And from there, you know, going and giving our life over to God, my mother has remained steadfast since. I myself personally have been in and out. You know, I'm not going to say and tell you I've been 100% committed since then. It's been a struggle, you know, and I'll be the first to admit it. It's definitely has been the greatest time out moment, you know, because it put me on a course to where we have today, which is a piece of me.
Right. And so your mom, you know, just the devastation of what happened with your nephew, tell us about how, you know, she just came to that decision. Did she come and talk to you or, you know, how did she make a decision to go clean?
She went straight to God after my nephew's death. She went straight to God, and she found her way to church. I don't know how she decided which church she wanted to go to, but she said she was going. You know, and us to have no relationship for all so many years, it was time for me to chuck it up and say, you know what, I need to go in there too and be supportive of her. You know, it wasn't even about me at the moment. It was about her. You know, So our relationship did not immediately grow from that one day, but my mother walked up to the altar, and I said, if my mother can go with her drug addictions, and the only thing I felt I was addicted to at the time was tattoos and women, which can be, you know, a problem, you know, if you're not handling yourself accordingly, if you're not mature. You know, so we went up there, gave our life to God, and found ourselves in church for the next couple of years straight. every day, but our relationship still didn't get to where it needed to be because she would not know how to say she was sorry, and I would not know how to forgive her for all the years of the hurt, pain that we had in the past. But yet we were telling the God that we love, that we can't see a touch, we love, you know, so it was very strange. And neither one was going to make that first move. We would walk by each other in church and still in there screaming, shouting, dressed up, dressed down, running up and down the aisle, but we wouldn't bridge that gap.
Right. And so at what point in time did you get to the point where you could forgive your mother?
It happened gradually, I would say, throughout the shows of my play, because as we were there, a young man came up to me and told me that God wanted him to give me the lead role in his play to be an actor. And, you know, when I looked at him and said, well, God didn't tell me that. You know, so throughout that, we talked, and I got into his script. I learned the role. We did the play, and I noticed that I could write the same thing. So I put my thoughts to paper. You know, the guy said, finish writing it, and, you know, we put it on the church. So I wrote the play in 4 days. Took me 30 days to edit it. And throughout these shows, as the years went on, my mother came to the shows, and I would give the same speech that I started with you, that she used drugs and she used this. And we gradually began, she started to realize it wasn't about her. It was about us helping other people and helping each other. So we gradually built up to where we started communicating. She was supportive of me. She was happy. I was glad she was there. You know, so that bond started, you know, walking towards each other. And we were able to sit down and talk, you know, various times, whether it was for 2 minutes or 10 minutes, the gap had begun.
Right. So now, what prompted you to write plays versus movies or sitcoms? Why plays?
It was what I had in front of me. I was studying the role for a play, you know, so I loved the way it was going. I loved some of the things that were in there, and I needed to express myself. And all my life, I was expressing myself through the pen.
Mm-hmm.
I would write songs. I would write poetry. I would write anything. You know, so the best way for me to express myself how I was feeling was to put it on paper. You know, and the name came to me so easy, a piece of me, because it was stuff that was in my belly, it was stuff that was in my system, it was stuff that was bothering me for years. You know, so the best format for me to get it out, which was in front of me, was a stage play. Now, I probably wouldn't have studied for a movie. It might have came out originally as a screenplay. You know, but what I had in front of me was a stage play, you know, that I was learning the role. And, I, you know, it just came out of me. And it was the best format to go with, and I ran with it.
And the play was called A Piece of Me?
Yes, the play was called A Piece of Me. It ran, we did 50 shows between 2005 and 2009, and close to almost 100 individuals turned their life over to God in 50 shows through the play. You know, I got to work with my oldest son. He acted in 49 of the 50 shows. He was the first African-American play ever in the Shawnee Playhouse in a building that was open for 100 years. You know, so we made some history, and, you know, it was a great run. But the most exciting thing after the shows, when churches would bring us in, you would see 19 people on the altar getting prayed for. You would see 10 people on the altar getting prayed for. You know,
wow.
So it was a beautiful thing. It was a beautiful thing to see people understanding forgiveness, you know, and some of the things that they said after the show were, you know, much, much better than any ticket receipt that you can get in your hand.
Right. Now, you said that you performed 50 shows across the East Coast in a 4-year span, actually. Where was the show most received out of all the cities that you traveled to?
I would say it was most received in Harlem because we did more Harlem and Brooklyn. We did more shows in Harlem and Brooklyn than anywhere. You know, we started off as a local production until I started venturing out at the time doing MySpace, and people were hearing about it and wanted to bring us certain places. And then I had to go with what was affordable. You know, I had to make sure I wrote it as a dry set. Those who know as a dry set is pretty much minimum stuff on stage as possible. You know, I would pack up a U-Haul with a table and a couch and like 6 chairs, and we're going and get a 15-passenger van with the cast, and we're out. You know, so, but Harlem and Brooklyn definitely were the most, you know, places that we were well-received. And I definitely want to mention they were the most affordable. Because when you're an independent production, you got to do it, you know, perform the way you can definitely try to meet your cap and meet your goals, you know. So Harlem and Brooklyn definitely gave us a lot of love.
Right. Now, did you also direct the plays or did you have a director?
Yeah, I directed the plays. I was self-directed probably 40 of the 50 shows. when I first started, somewhere in the first 15 shows, I had about 2 shows because it did become overwhelming, you know, didn't know what was going on, and then the attacks came because I had no idea I was doing God's work. So some of the things that came, I just, you know, didn't see and couldn't predict. You know, but I wrote it, directed, produced it, you know, pretty much solely by myself.
Wow. Now, what's your favorite part about the day, like the day you have a play showing, like in Harlem? What's your favorite part of that process?
The favorite part definitely will always be right now is to meet the people after the show. After every show, I make sure my cast gets off that stage and join me at the back door, and we shake everybody's hand that came out to see the play. Because I believe in you should be able to relate to the people. You know, there's definitely a point where you can't do that no more. I'm pretty sure, you know, Tyler Perry, when he started, he can do that if he chose to. But there's a point now he can't. You know, but with God puts you to a point where you can talk to the people, relate to the people. Because we spoke to people who have been raped 5 times and said this is the best therapy they ever had. We spoke to people who doctors told them they couldn't have any more kids, could never get pregnant, and now they are. You know, so the stories that we hear from the people after seeing the play, you know, they're just mind-blowing, and to me that's the best part.
Right. It keeps you going when you hear,
it keeps,
you know,
it keeps
how
you
touch people's lives. Yeah. What's
it
your least
you
favorite part? What was your least favorite part of putting on a production?
I would say the least favorite part is reminding the actors to get into character an hour before the show. I think I'm one of the worst individuals to deal with an hour, 2 hours before the show. Because I'm a firm believer, if your name is Cheryl in the play, we should be not calling you Karen 2 hours, an hour before the show. Everybody should recognize you as Sharon or Cheryl, whatever case, whoever you're playing. You know, you should be so into character because you're doing the God's work. If you were in a production and you did a show with us last week or 2 weeks before, you see what we out here doing. It's more than a stage play. It became ministry. You know, if people run up to you saying, look, I was homeless, I can relate. You hit it on the head. Or, you know, I can deal with infidelity. Or, you know what, my sister's a former lesbian who's struggling with her sexuality, and, you know, God is working on her. So you have to realize God is putting you on that stage to help somebody out there.
Right.
And on top of that, this may be their last $20, and they spent it on you. You know,
right.
So you got to go out there and give it your best. So that's one of the worst things, that if I got to remind someone that, you know, get into character and take this seriously, because every time you go on stage, you should do it like it's your last.
Right. Game face is on.
That's right.
Now, you were nominated 5 times for a Tiffany Award. What was it like when you finally received the Tiffany Award in 2008?
Oh, it was a great feeling. It was a great feeling. I kind of, you know, I was in that mood where, you know, God gives the reward, man gives the award. So, you know, I was happy to be nominated, happy to receive it. But when it came a couple years later after getting nominated, I was like, you know what, let's just keep pushing. You know, let's just keep pushing. Because if one group can recognize us, another group can recognize us. And it was a great honor because I was a newbie. I was a freshman. I was unknown, you know, so to get honored by your peers, It was a great thing. It was a great thing. We had 5 nominations. We had Best Stage Play, Best Actor, Best Supporting Actress, Best Director, Best Writer. You know, so people came there and actually said, you know what, I love what these people are doing. And that is an honor for you to sit down and put your work down and a stranger appreciate it.
Right.
You know, I loved it.
Now, how has being a playwright opened doors for you?
Well, it definitely opened up the doors to meet people that I never thought I would meet and to go places that I never would go. And on top of that, I got a chance to work with my son. You know, my son got a chance to see us pack up for a show, get dressed for a show, perform a show, you know, and then on top of that, to go out there and to do God's work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was just a mind blower right there. You know, we did shows for 15 people. We did shows for 700 people. We did shows for thousands of people. And when
right.
I tell you some of the best criticism, the best critique we received were in front of 15. They
right.
flat out had the show was just for them, and we talked to them for hours after the show. And to see people cry, to see people share, and then in turn, weeks later, to have some of those people that are in the crowd performing in the play. Because I open up the doors. If you're serious about your dream, you're serious about your passion, and this is what you do, you know, come on. You know, we have people travel from 2 hours away to come to rehearsals once a week. From Connecticut to New York, Jersey to New York 45 minutes away because they loved their craft, they loved what they were doing, and they loved the product and the project. So it's just, it was a total blessing.
Wow. Now, A Piece of Me play actually became a book. What
yes.
message did you want to get across to your readers through the book versus the play? Like when you wrote that book, what was the message that you wanted to get across?
I want to get across that you can continuously chase your dreams, you know, because it was a stage play, it doesn't have to stop there. You know, I always felt, you know, talking to my partner, Yolanda Moore, for Everyday Publishing Group, that, you know, well, we can get a message across America quicker as a book than we can as a stage play. You know, and so your dreams don't have to stop because you made one point. When you get to one finish line, God's going to create another. You know, if he gets you to one place where he wants you to go, he's going to create another. So the race don't stop once you get somewhere. You know, so God gives you a vision, and you can help close to 100 people get their relationship back to God with a play. Maybe go out there and go get 200 more with a book.
Wow,
you know,
I like
sometimes
that.
Sometimes you can be the closest thing someone get to a Bible, and you still don't have all your stuff together, but God can use you,
mm-hmm.
you know, how he wants you and how he needs you, and he can put you down when he finishes with you.
Wow, I like that. Now, how did you go about, you said that you started a publishing company, so that's, you published your own book?
Yes, yes, started it in 2012 with Yolanda Moore. The first
mm-hmm.
book was her book, You Will Win If You Don't Quit, which is a great book, great, great book. So those who don't got it, go out there and get it. It's on Yolanda's site. And we put out a fundamentals economy book with Robert Haynes. And then my book came out this year. You know, so it was good to self-publish because, you know, there was no timetable. There was no push. There was no, you know, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
There was no machine. So whatever you do, it's from the efforts that you put into it. You know, and Yolanda
right.
was super supportive. You know, I was so tired of writing the book and tweaking with it and playing with it. And Yolanda just flat out said, this is no good. You can't cheat the people that saw the play and give them the same thing as a play. You have to give them something fresh and something new. So she challenged me to write, you know, different parts in the beginning, different parts in the middle, different parts in the end. You know, so you got to have those people around you who are going to give you the flat out truth so you can put the best product out there.
Right. Now, how did you go about getting an actual publishing company?
Yolanda got online, did some research. We threw ideas back and forth, and you know, she had a vision, you know, shared it. You know, I supported it. I had a vision, so I shared it with her. She supported it and said, you know what, let's get online and do some research. Everything you need to know, people need to know in this world, is online today. You know, you have a friend inbox you for an idea because they don't want to pay somebody else, but everything is online. You know, go sit down, do the research, get you a pen and pad, and look at the do's and don'ts. You know, look out of copyright, look out of publishing, look up an ISBN. You know, everything you need to know is online. And Yolanda sat down and did some research, shared it. We agreed, lock and load, and move forward. Pushed her book, pushed another book, and pushed mine.
Wow. I've had a series of writers on my show for the past few weeks. We had Ryan Winfield, who wrote a romance novel called Jane's Melody, bestseller. Last week we had Tanya Bianc, who is the author of Army Wives, and I asked both of them this same question. What do you do when you get writer's block?
I pretty much put the pen down. My thing is, if I sit down and what I got, the idea don't come to me in 15 minutes, I leave it alone because I'm forcing it. You know, so I can go back to a piece that I wrote 5 years ago and go to that one. You know, so if I'm stuck on an idea, because sometimes you can write something and you just have to stop because you're forcing it or it don't make sense no more and come back to it. You know, a lot of my visions come to me in the least craziest places while I'm asleep on the train, you know, so people don't understand I can write an entire book inside my smartphone.
Hmm.
And everybody say, how do you do that? You know, because it comes to me in the strangest places. You know, I'd rather
right.
write while I'm traveling, whether it's on a bus or on a plane, on a city train. You know, sometimes that's when I could write better in chaos because that's what I was used to growing up.
Hmm. Wow.
Made you pause for a minute. Sometimes you have to find your comfort in your discomfort, right?
Jermaine, are you there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. I lost you for a second. So how do you put yourself in chaotic positions? That's interesting that you said you grew up in chaos, and so you tend to write better in chaotic situations.
Well, I do it two ways. Either I take myself back there mentally to a situation such as, you know, my mother broke up with a gentleman one day. They had a fight, broke her arm. 2 weeks later, he's on America's Most Wanted for killing another woman. You know, so I can take myself back mentally to situations like that where God had to have a hedge around us, you know, with different men coming in and out the house or the moans of sex going on. You know what I mean? So I can take myself back to those moments where they're mentally painful, where they're emotionally painful, or I can just get on the New York City subway train where there's nothing but noise going on around, or a city bus. You know, so those are the easiest two ways right there for me to sit down and get the pen in.
Now, is it possible for you to write out of a peaceful space, too?
I believe it's possible. And I've told people this many times, I don't know if I can ever have a mansion or have a home with a den and a basement and it's peaceful and quiet and me writing. I don't see it. You know, it's very much possible, but I don't see it because it's not what I'm accustomed to and it's not, you know, how I can envision myself writing. You know, but, you know, you never know if you put yourself in that environment. I'm pretty sure I can do it, but will I go back and be as painful? I don't know. You know, I equate it to 50 Cent. His first album to me was so great because of the environment he was in when he was writing it. Not to say his music is not different or better now or worse, but he's in a different environment now. You're not in an environment where the bullets are flying over your head now. You're in a safer environment because you know who you are and your status and things have changed. You know, so if the environment changes, the writing may change, the mentality may change. I'm not sure. You know, but I've definitely felt easier writing in, you know, in chaos because that's what I know and it's a learned behavior.
Wow. That's interesting because when I think about myself, I wrote my best papers under pressure. I mean, like if I had two weeks to write a paper and I started, or 2 months even, and I started my paper in those 2 months and I wrote a little bit and then I put it down, I wrote a little bit and I put it down, that might have been a, you know, B, C, maybe paper. But when it was, you know, 12 o'clock midnight and I had a 5-page, 6-page paper to write by the next day, I cranked out some of my best work. And it translated on a basketball court. Like, I wanted to shoot that last shot. You know, I just kind of had that go-to mentality in the classroom, on the court. And now I even find when my back is against a wall and I have to do something by tomorrow, I'll get it done. But if I have weeks to do it, I don't know, call me a procrastinator, I don't know, but it's almost as if I have to go back to just, you know, it's 10 seconds on the clock, Sylvia, what are you going to do? You know, you got to score. So I think you've tapped into something. I just hate for you to write out of a space of pain every time you want to do good work. I'm hoping that you'll get to the place where you can write out of peace and quietness and not have to be so chaotic for you to draw from every time.
I don't know if I want to write from peace because at the end of the day, you know, there's a lot of people that are so stuck in pain that, you know, we need to recognize them. They need to see that they're not the only ones going through and that they can come out. You know, so good things come out of writing if the good things come out of me writing in my pain for someone else, I can live with that. You know, because I feel God can be covered and I'll be all right. So if I can write something about someone going through something and it helps them, I'm cool with that. Because I would definitely believe God will keep me covered and keep me, you know, wondering, keep his hand on my mind if I'm doing right for him.
That's a different way of looking at it. What's next for Jermaine Smith?
Next, I just want to continue to see my boys grow, be a great dad, be a great influence for them, and try to do things that resonate 10, 20, 15 years from now, you know, and let the work speak for itself. You know, right now I just finished writing a piece of me as a stage play, you know, so basically just pushing the novel, trying to get the word out, trying to let, you know, continue the feedback and keep growing. Finish the screenplay, working on a sequel to a piece of me, and, you know, in due time, you know, try to get it all out in God's time.
Wow. How do you want to be remembered, Jermaine?
Someone who didn't quit. you know, someone who took the opportunities that were given to him and made something of it. You know, basically seize the moment. You know, seize the moment. You can be in your 15 minutes of fame. You can be in your 12th minute, but use that 12 or the last three, you know, the best way possible. You know, so I think that's the best way to be remembered, you know, as a dad, as a father. So, you know, if I could really raise these two boys to be good adults, I did my thing. I did my time right on earth.
Right. Jermaine, what would you say to someone who's listening who may not have had their father or may not have had, you know, the best upbringing, but they have dreams and goals? What would you say to that young person?
I would say the first thing to do is keep God first. You know, without God first, none of it is possible. You know, it's a reason why God is pushing you on. It's a reason why God gave you that gift. You know, so the main thing is to get started. You know, so you got to realize, you know, in order to be great, you have to get started. You know, so if you can't get started, there's no way to get great. So you got to constantly hone your gifts. You got to practice your craft. You got to practice your craft. You got to practice your craft. You know, you can't judge your success on based on where somebody else is at with their success. You know, so keep your eyes on your vision, study your craft, and don't judge how far you are based on somebody else. You don't know what they had to do to get to where they're going. You don't know how they're being used, you know, so I would definitely say that. Keep God first and foremost, because without God, and if you didn't have a father in your life or a mother in your life or your parents, you know, try to get somebody that's close to God, have a relationship to God, you know, and keep the positive people around you.
Right. Jermaine, tell our listeners how they can keep up with you through social media or website.
Yes, you can reach me on my website, www.thejayeveryday.com. That's thejayeveryday.com. On Facebook, I'm Jay Everyday The Brand Everyday. That's Jay Everyday The Brand Everyday. On LinkedIn, you can find me at Jermaine Jay Everyday Smith. And on Twitter, you can find me. The easiest one is Everyday Radio. Everyday Radio, and I follow back, I support back, I try to put out encouraging tweets, posts, everything, you know, try to make you laugh, try to keep you encouraged, you know, a lot of times I'm encouraging myself, you know, and just try to be, you know, do the same things every day.
Now, I will tell our listeners, if you reach out to Jermaine, he will reach back out to you. I am his friend on most social medias, and he is very active on those, so you can interact with him on those sites. Jermaine, you, all of your social sites say something to the effect of J, Everyday The Brand, or just Everyday The Brand. Did you have someone marketing-wise to work with you on branding yourself? Because I think you do a really good job of being consistent with how people interact with you socially.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. But no, I didn't have no one sit me down and give me the runaround. I pretty much just said, you know what, I want to spend 10 minutes of every hour on a social network. You know what I mean? Trying to spread the same message every day. 2011 to 2012, I put out a perfume called Everyday for Women, which was an honor to my mother and my aunts, because no one recognizes the everyday woman or the everyday individual. Mm-hmm. For example, if you look at a magazine, you don't see everyday people. A lot of everyday people drive minivans, drive these $18,000 cars or $12,000 cars, but in the magazine you see $40,000 cars, $35,000 cars. Everyday people can't get that. Who buys these magazines? Everyday people. Who buys perfume? Who buys shoes? Everyday people. But you know what? You don't never see us on radio, mainstream radio. You don't ever see us, everyday people, in magazines. You don't very rarely see everyday people in commercials. You know what I mean? So I want to do something for everyday people, and I want to do something for the individual who's down to earth, who we can touch, who supports the economic system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I want to do something for everyday, because I know what I experienced every day, and I know what keeps me going every day, and I know what wakes me every day. So that pretty much, you know, wanted to be, you know, my mark on how I felt and how I wanted to move.
Wow. Well, Jermaine, I want to thank you for taking time out to be with us tonight. You know, you dropped some nuggets on me. I've been tweeting as you were talking during the show, but, you know, I like your advice that you give to young people who are trying to aspire their dream, and just keeping God first And I love what you said about how whenever you complete one thing, God will give you another finish line to push towards, you know. And so I just want to encourage you to keep doing what you're doing, keep blessing other people. I have been able to see through social media, I've never even met you personally, but I've seen how you've been able to bless other people in their projects and their books. So, you know, sometimes you help other people and you never really get to see the seeds or the fruit of that. So on behalf of all the people that and all the lives that you've touched along the way through your play when people were giving their lives to Christ, I want to say thank you to you for what you do and thank you for being a positive male role model in our community and for showing people everyday people. You know, you're right. You don't see everyday people in magazines, on commercials. And so with all the reality TV that's going on, I think our kids are being misled a lot of times. You know, they're chasing fame. They want to be famous. And that's the reason why I have this show. You know, you want to be famous? Well, listen to what Jermaine went through in order to get his book published, in order to get his play started. You know, look at what these people had to go through in order to get that, because it's not just, you know, fame just drops on your head one day. You know, people go through a process, and out of their story births, you know, a business or births a book or births, you know, a company or something like that. And so so I just wanted to thank you for what you do for everyday people. Is there something else that you want to say before we close? Because we are out of time.
Yeah, I just want to tell people, keep pushing forward, chase your dream, regardless if you got to sleep on the floor, regardless if you don't have to buy new clothes for 2 years, keep chasing your dream. It's all about a sacrifice. You're going to lose in one area of your life to gain in another. So you just got to keep pushing forward and stay positive. And drink it all, even if it tastes too strong.
You heard it from Jermaine Smith. That's my time. This is Time Out with Sylvia Crowley. Tune in with us next week. We have Derek Anderson, former NBA player, former Ohio State Buckeye, who transferred to Kentucky. He's better known as DA. We'll have him here interviewing next week. So we will see you then, same place, same time. Have a blessed week.
Tell me what you want, tell me what you see, where you want to go, what you want to be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of prayer. If you take your time, gotta be precise, gotta have a plan, double check it twice. Wait, hold up, slow down, devil need advice. Someone's gone before, maybe talk to them. Then after you do, go and talk to him. Great, it's gonna come, maybe not tonight. Take your time today, teach you something right.
Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends. Twitter, you the trend, him a Bentley Benz. But you moving kind of fast. Keep sweating, you gotta make it last. Live every day like it's your last. But don't forget to have a blast.